Good evening, this is Mae Brussel. This is World Watchers, a one-hour news program. It's program number 776, October the 20th, 1986. I'm going to continue with part two of the Daniloff story, Nicholas Daniloff, because I know it is very, very important, his role as a Tsarist white Russian, his location in Argentina, the years he was there, his period at Harvard University, with their very strongly anti-Soviet programs across the board, and I'll cite a few of them, and the role he played with disinformation, with trying to get, when Mark Lane was trying to get the investigation of the murder of John Kennedy and Martin Luther King opened up again, that gray area that William Colby used, I referred to last week, with implanting a name of Richard Feldman and quoting him to get into the congressional record, the non-existent Richard Feldman, a la UPI News Service. There is so much news going on that I don't like to put it aside, but this isn't putting it aside. This is very, very important to understand people like Nicholas Daniloff, how the emergency to get him home, how Ronald Reagan, the President of the United States, was forced to meet Mr. Gorbachev on such short notice. The smugness of this person, the support of the State Department, all journalists around the world identifying and coming in. They had to get him home. They absolutely couldn't have him break down or talk in a Soviet jail. If he was innocent, there just couldn't be that much clamor and acclaim or even the threat of breaking off arms talks and so forth. He was very, very important. And furthermore, he does link to an area that I suspect is possibly the only one that would cause the commotion it did. And that would be if the Soviet Union knew in any way, shape, or form, and is figured out by now and has fired people and charged them with crimes, people who allowed the Chernobyl nuclear disaster to happen and the political effect it has had on the Soviet Union that will never wash away, because now we can blame hundreds or thousands or many thousands of cancers on the evil empire. As I said last week, when the broadcast was over, I was quoting a New York Times article. It was September the 9th, 1986, on the background of Daniloff, titled Nicholas Daniloff, the Bolsheviks' Prisoner. And it goes into his friends in the Soviet Union that he liked theater and music, and he also developed a fascination with the Russian space exploits and wrote a book about them. As I said before, and I haven't been able to locate the book on the Soviet space exploits. Who did he interview in the Soviet Union under the guise of writing a book? Priscilla Johnson went on and wrote a book, Marina and Lee, and wrote the script of how Lee Oswald was supposed to have treated Marina Oswald, a journalist who wrote a book that turned history around, or she thought she could. And her husband wrote a book on Martin Luther King's assassination. Incidentally, it was at the home of Macmillan and her father that Svetlana Stalin was taken when she was taken out of the Soviet Union by the CIA. She stayed at the home of the Macmillans. So they were involved in that process of bringing Svetlana as part of the Cold War, of lying about Lee and Marina Oswald's role, and lying about James Earl Ray in the murder of Martin Luther King. And Mr. Daniloff was lying about quoting a person who was non-existent, who was trying to place the blame on people wanting to open up the assassination investigation of John Kennedy and Martin Luther King. He interjects himself into that in spite of the fact or because of his work also as a journalist in Russia. And interestingly enough, as I say, he wrote about the space program. Now, the space program has to include rockets, rocket factories, atomic plants. Now, someone inside the Soviet Union, as I say, a Galen agent, somebody worked for Wernher von Braun, the very people that made the space rockets for Germany, a good percentage, as I said before, talking about Chernobyl, went to live in Russia and planned for a long, long time, of course, the overthrow of the Soviet Union. And I believed that the Chernobyl effect was done by those people who could sabotage that incident. Now, the head of the Soviet Union, Mr. Gorbachev, wasn't told for several days, and articles, maybe several hundred I've read in the course of that time period since Chernobyl, accuse the Soviet Union of being a closed society where they keep secrets from their own. And how can you trust them when they don't tell their own about Gorbachev, But they always ignore the fact that Mr. Gorbachev wasn't told himself. And you can't force people to tell you something until they're ready to tell you. And if you hold it back 2 days, then you make him look like a clown that never could be trusted. And then the U.S. Information Agency, which is the CIA and State Department, got on the radio and told the Ukraine that you've been nuked, that all this nuclear waste is coming at you. And they waited until the radiation was picked up by other countries, Sweden, and so forth, and then said, look, we know you're the last to know. And then the credibility of the leaders, as I say, was destroyed. And the only possible way to turn this around for the Soviet Union is to show Ronald Reagan that they understand the process by which we use propaganda, such as the Korean airline and so forth. And you see in the news this week the stories of disinformation and lies about deniability about George Bush and the CIA funding the Contras, when everybody has read for the past 6 years the involvement of the CIA and the Knights of Malta and the Vatican and the private organizations that are directly linked to the National Security Agency, to the Defense Department, the CIA, and George Bush allegedly got Mr. Gomez a job in El Salvador, and then they fly the planes from there. If the former director of the CIA does those things, he's involved in those things when he gets jobs for people within the agency who then say, I don't know anyone in the agency. So with the quick summit that was called this last week by Mr. Gorbachev, he said, come on, Ronnie, let's meet in Iceland. And they met. And Danilov was never known for a lot of acquaintances, but he knew some well. And one described in the New York Times is Raoul Sagedev, S-A-G-E-D-V-Y-E-V, Raoul, R-A-R-O-A-L-D, Sagedev. He's the head of the Space Research Institute, and Danilov was working with him at the Space Research Institute. Well, were any of those the old Punamunda boys or the sons of the Punamunda? Here's Danilov, who's the son of a man whose father was a spy for the Tsar and intelligence, grandfather, part of an assassination team to kill the Tsar. Who knows who runs the Space Research Institute? I'm sure that Mr. Gorbachev can find out or knows by now. And the article goes on, many of Danilov's friends were willing to call on the presumably bugged apartment telephone, denouncing the KGB in strong terms. His apartment that radiates out of central Moscow is one of the few buildings not guarded around the clock by Soviet police because the phones are bugged. Well, if they're bugged, I'm sure that the KGB, if there was any link of Danilov to anything like Chernobyl, and they were going to leak this at his trial, his leaks with the space people, imagine the shock it would have to the Western world. And imagine the way Ronald Reagan had to meet Mr. Gorbachev last week, considering all this that was happening. Now, this article goes on, the State Department couldn't have picked a worse person in terms of his well-known and favorably known personality as Mr. Danilov throughout Washington, the press corps, and the State Department. This is a quotation of Frank Sieverts, Special Assistant for Public Affairs of the State Department Bureau for Refugee Programs. And, of course, refugees are the nucleus of the anti-Russian Cold War, Hot War articles and organizations and protests, and the Jewish refugees and the protest groups. Now, it's interesting that the Special Assistant for Public Affairs, State Department Bureau for Refugee Programs, is Frank Sieverts. This man's position is in 1985. He just happened to be a classmate of Nicholas Danilov at Oxford before Danilov picked up the UPI credentials to go to Moscow at a time in 1961 after the Gary Powers trial, when Oswald's in Minsk and Priscilla Johnson's coming home and Marina's going to come to the United States. Frank Sieverts is talking about how prominent Nicholas Danilov is in the State Department, with the press corps, throughout Washington, D.C., and the man who says it happens to be his roommate. Now, you go from Paris to Argentina, you go to Argentina to Harvard, then to London, Oxford, and then you work for an interim in the State Department and with the Defense Department and the White House, and Mr. Sieverts, the Special Assistant for Public Affairs there for refugees, just happens to be the roommate of Danilov at Oxford at the same time. That's always interesting, just a classmate, rather. So the question, did Mr. Sieverts take that Harvard refugee, Mr. Danloff, in to Oxford, where they both handpicked to work for the State Department after 1965, for the Defense Department, for the White House? Obviously, they were. They meet up again with very important positions that have to do with anti-Soviet anger and propaganda. Now, in 1983, on the anniversary, 20th anniversary of Kennedy's assassination, I mentioned last week, I wrote that article for Larry Flint when he started the magazine Rebel on the Nazi connections to the Kennedy assassination. Now, the questions I brought up in that article, and it's about 2 years, I've never had a response from a single Kennedy researcher in the United States that either said, May, that's wrong, or where did you get it, or you're off the wall, or let's pursue it. And they don't pursue these things, and they look at them with arm's distance. Either they're too lazy to do the work, or they're too dumb to understand it. Some are obviously agents that I'm not supposed to be knowing these things that I figured out. Some people are just too ignorant to understand what it is I'm saying. There's a lot of researchers that still, 2 years later, don't understand what I was saying. Now, I just want to repeat some sentences from what I published. People say, why don't you write a book? And I say, you don't understand the articles I've written. If you read all of those, then I'll write a book for you. But people don't understand them. Now, among other things in this article, I was talking about Lee Oswald's connections to DISC, the Defense Industry Security Command. And I mentioned that when he applied for a tourist card to enter Mexico in New Orleans in September 1963, he was with four other persons, and they had consecutive tourist numbers. They departed 9 days later than Oswald. They all arrived at the same time. They entered from different cities. They were part of that white Russian Solidaris Galen emigre community that Lee and Marina mingled with. And again, when he got his passport in the Soviet, in New Orleans in 1963, he was ready to take another trip. Without his wife, he wanted a separate passport. He had a wife and two children, and he applied for a passport to leave the country that he would have in his pocket. He must have known something was going to cook up because he was actually a good family man, but agents don't have that choice. They have to travel. And then after he got the passport, he was with these white Russian czars when he went to Mexico. And in that same article, I was bringing up links of the CIA to the Kennedy assassination, and again, these go back to that time period with Danloff in Moscow, titled John Tower, Senator John Tower and Marina Oswald. One of the most consistent conservatives among William Buckley's Young Americans for Freedom Advisory Board was Senator John Tower of Texas. Now, also on the Young Americans for Freedom Advisory Board was Ronald Reagan and Robert Morris, the attorney, and Charles Willoughby from Hitler's Kriegsakademie, who became chief of intelligence for Douglas MacArthur. So we're not talking about a bunch of wimps now. We're talking about John Tower of Texas. And I wrote, if there's anything he wouldn't want in his backyard, it was a defector from Russia and his allegedly communist wife from Minsk. Yet 2 years after joining the Young Americans for Freedom in 1962 on the board with Ronald Reagan, Tower passed all waivers in order for Marina Oswald to get to the United States as soon as possible. Without his permission, the trip might never have been taken. Many wives from the USSR are not that lucky. And in that time period, that's when Danloff was in Moscow, when they were ready to come home, and they had to go to the embassy. And he's from the UPI, and here's a defector coming home, so you may want to know something that's going on. I wrote, March 22, 1962, Senator Tower cooperated. The sanctions imposed on immigration and nationality are hereby waived in behalf of Mrs. Oswald. The file check on Marina by FBI, CIA, Department of Secret Service, and the Division of Biographical Intelligence and Passport Office cleared her 100%. This is volume 24, page 296 of the Warren Commission hearings. George de Morenchild testified in volume 9, page 228 and 229, that Marina Oswald's father was a czarist officer of some kind. I don't remember whether it was the Navy or the Army. And again, the czarist officer has a connection to the Danloff family. Papa, Grandpa, Great-Grandpa, the whole gang. Her real father was never identified in 26,000 pages of the Warren Commission hearings by any name or testimony. Between 1948 and 1950, over 200 Belarusian Nazis from the Ukraine and their families were brought to New Jersey. Both Georgia Moore and Sheldon Marina came from Minsk as part of the Belarusian area. The Galen Nazi emigres were useful to every part of the Kennedy assassination and to the cover-up. Then the next section I wrote about was the Argentine connections, and I mentioned those earlier last week, just a week ago, because of the Danilovs having in common the Tsar's background, the proximity to Moscow and the intelligence community, journalists working with the State Department and CIA, working with Lee and Marina Oswald before and after the assassination, working with her after. And I mentioned the Argentine connection of the Warren Report that wasn't published until September 64, yet as early as June 1964, an avowed anti-communist Isaac Don Levine, an arch-enemy of communism, an expert on the Soviet mind, was arranging for the Warren Commission to take the daughters of Alexander Zeiger from Minsk Radio Factory to Argentina. And Oswald told a journalist, a CIA person working for the State Department, he would soon be in that radio factory. And I wrote, what is that about? When the Oswalds left Russia, they smuggled out a message from relatives of the Zeigers in the United States. They wanted their daughters out of Russia. The daughters claimed they were born in Argentina. They could claim Argentine citizenship, and Isaac Levine was suggesting that the CIA get them out of Russia. And this was from memorandum from David Slauson, May 23, 1964, Warren Commission memorandum, and I mentioned Slauson's notations about the circumstances of a flag being put on Oswald's return papers, but it wasn't there. And all the notifications that he's coming back were not there. And a few members of the commission picked up some of these little tidbits, but they never pursued them any further. And so then I went into, in the same article, Treason for My Daily Bread, and the connections of Argentine and Martin Bormann, the head of the Nazi financial planning for the resurgence of the Fourth Reich. If the Third failed, he replaced Rudolf Hess, position as second under Adolf Hitler. And in 1971, a French paper referred to Martin Bormann as being behind the Kennedy murders. This was published August 1971, and it listed an international band of killers located in Texas. They carried out two assassinations at the German command. This is out of the London Guardian. They said Bormann was linked to the Kennedy murder by way of a book, Treason for My Daily Bread, by Nikolai Lebedev. Now, as of this date, I don't know any other Kennedy researcher who's written a book, who's even referred to Treason for My Daily Bread, to the relationship of Martin Bormann in Paraguay, in Argentina, to his connection to people who murdered John Kennedy. These allegations fit in with Paris Lamont's book, The Kennedy Conspiracy, and the Torbid document, The Nomenclature of an Assassination Cabal. And you can see why Nicholas Donilov would, in 1977, try to stop the House Rules Committee by using a gray matter, a CIA matter, a fictitious name with UPI, just to try and slander the committee. We don't know what they did behind their back, because certainly putting G. Robert Blakey in, working with the CIA, assured that they would never get into any of these areas. And I was writing, referring to this book and writing about the relationship of Otto Skorzeny, working with the CIA, and Reinhard Galen, and Martin Bormann, and the funds that were put in Evita Peron's banks that would be shared after 1952. Now, did Nicholas Danilov's family get any of this money? They were in Argentina, avowed anti-communist. They moved up to New Hampshire, sent them to Harvard, and then Oxford, and then to Switzerland. And lo and behold, he's unleashed, like I say, to go do the things he's going to do in Russia, then come back to Russia later, where he becomes the cause celeb for this big scandal, where he's picked up by the Russians just before he's ready to come home to the United States and charged with being a spy. And then the State Department and the press and the President of the United States say, send him home or else this will endanger our relationships. We can't have a summit with you next year. If you keep Danilov, there's no summit. And then lo and behold, they say, okay, we'll meet in 2 weeks or a week. Yeah, we'll get together. How important was all this? And G. Robert Blakey kept the lid on all of the connections of Argentine, of the Warren Commission, of the Nazi connections, of the Solidaris, of the White Russians, and also the Bunge Corporation from Argentina was involved in the assassination of John Kennedy. I won't go into details. You can read that. But there were many Argentine connections to the murder of John Kennedy. And, of course, the shtick of the John Kennedy murder, the press, the CIA use of the press, was to say that because Lee Harvey Oswald had a Russian wife and been the Soviet Union, he was a communist. And the whole slant of using this woman who was brought back to this Dallas-Fort Worth area, who worked with the Tolstoy Foundation, the Greek Orthodox Church, the whole thing about using her was to use the media to influence opinions around the world and the United States that the Russians were involved in a conspiracy. Now, this intent of the CIA and news media backfired on the very people who planned what they were doing. Sometimes they're just too clever for their own good. And what happened was, by immediately saying Oswald did it alone, as Dan Rather was saying at the radio station, you know, November 24th, the same line out of ABC, NBC, CBS, Oswald did it alone. They opened and closed the case in 2 days and then slammed away that Oswald was a Marxist, Oswald had a Russian wife, he went to Russia. And it was the symphony of the media that orchestrated this thing that demanded a Warren Commission be formed, or a commission be formed, to investigate the murder of John Kennedy. If they had just let Oswald been killed and not say he did it, and had a quiet Texas investigation, and didn't close it within 2 hours of when John Kennedy was murdered, putting Oswald in the jail in that evening, having press conferences, he's the one, he's the only one, and J. Edgar Hoover saying he's the one, he's the only one. This went all over the world, and that is what forced the commission to be formed. Now, the media responded too heavily to Nicholas Daniloff. They know he knows too much. They know what he's done in the State Department, the Defense Department, the White House. They were ready to get him home. He had served his time with the U.S. News and World Report, his anti-Russian material. I have to go back now and read some of those stuff. I never took or read that paper. It's worse than Time and Newsweek, if you can believe it. So now I have to go to the library and look up the years when Daniloff was writing for them, these past years from 1981 to 86, to see the lines of what he was writing and what his name was attached to. And we have to do our homework and find the book that he did on the space program. Because in this case, when Daniloff was picked up, instead of quietly saying, well, okay, have a trial, what'd you find on him? The mistake that Mrs. Daniloff made and Nicholas Daniloff made was some kind of arrangement where they probably thought they'd blast the future summit, just as Gary Powers was caught as a spy, and then he'd get off on minor charges after all of this brahu. But what happened was they got so much news media in it, starting with the New York Times and Washington Post, and then all the editorial writers, that it actually forced the immediate summit that was never planned by Ronald Reagan and Mr. Gorbachev. Now, what they discussed there in terms of arms and missiles and nuclear testing isn't important, except the fact that they were forced to get together and say a few other things, I am sure, in the interim, when they met privately. And they said no press allowed. So the press of the world took the advantage of 3 days of silence to interview every single person who's anti-Russian. You heard Zbigniew Brzezinski on the air, and Jean Kirkpatrick, and Michael Ledeen, and Henry Kissinger, and all the people from the Georgetown Center of Strategic Studies, and all the violent anti-communists, used this chance of Daniloff's arrest and release to have 3 days of bad-mouthing that went on continuously, criticizing Mrs. Gorbachev for attending, and Nancy Reagan didn't attend. And I want to go into some of those articles and the way the news media covered those events. Now, September the 11th, 1986, San Jose Mercury had an article, An Earlier Brush with the Secret Police. This was written by Ruth Daniloff. 2 years ago, in 1984, Soviet microbiologist David Goldfarb was ready to emigrate to Israel. And on his way, he gave Nicholas Daniloff a book. That's like Daniloff giving a book to Misha. I don't know why when you leave you have to hand people books and get the books all the time they want. I don't know why as a farewell they have to give them each other a book. On leaving, Daniloff was photographed by the KGB. The KGB took Dr. Goldfarb to Lubyanka prison and confronted him with his picture of Daniloff. So they've been watching him for a long, long time with his background. Men were sent to search Goldfarb's apartment, Dr. Goldfarb's apartment, where they found some biological strains, and they accused him of wanting to smuggle them out of the Soviet Union with Nicholas Daniloff's help. Now, what in the heck they were doing with these, I don't know. Incidentally, I want to thank Andy for giving me this article. I take the San Jose Mercury, but I didn't see this article. It wasn't in my edition, and I want to thank him for that. There's some great researchers out there who provide David Emery and me with the very interesting little pieces that we miss and don't see that make the total picture come together a lot better. The article goes on, there were a lot of protests from Western scientists, and the case was dropped. Nicky Daniloff gets everyone behind him when these stories come up, and the Soviet Union so far had backed down. While this was going on, the KGB repeatedly suggested to Goldfarb they would drop his case if he would help them, they would let him leave the Soviet Union if he would ask Daniloff to take a package out of the country. Goldfarb said, "I'm an old, one-legged Jew. I don't have much time to live. Whether I go to Israel or not does not make a difference." And Ruth Daniloff wrote, "We would walk our dog out of earshot of microphones 3 months before getting ready to leave Moscow." Now, here's an interesting part of this story. Because Nick was going to have a spy charge thrown at him. 3 months before they're leaving, they walk and talk where they're not bugged, because he's going to be charged as a spy before he leaves. She says, "Nick's weekend visits with the old man Goldfarb were almost sacred. He intended to see Goldfarb in the hospital the very Saturday that Daniloff was arrested by the KGB. On Nick's last visit, Goldfarb said, 'Don't worry, I'll be out before you leave.' Goldfarb's son, Alexander, who lives in New York City, said after Daniloff visited him, his treatment was better and top Soviet specialists came in to take care of his medical conditions." Now, the issue isn't about whether or not Mr. Goldfarb is going to be allowed to leave. He was arrested because of his contacts to Daniloff. But what were the biological strains that he was making in his apartment, this old, sick, one-legged man, to take to Israel? And of course, these emigres say their life ambition is to go to Israel, and they won't let us to be with these other Jews. But as you see, Alexander Goldfarb lives in New York City and not Israel. And after they're left out of the Soviet Union, they usually go through Vienna, and they're directly recruited for spies against the Soviet Union. So Ruth Daniloff is revealing something September the 11th, when she said they knew 3 months earlier that he was going to be arrested. Now, if they knew 3 months earlier, through June, July, and August, then why in the world would he meet Misha in a park and give him maps of Afghanistan if he knew it? And remember, it was Mr. Taubman from the New York Times that went to her apartment and said a reporter has been arrested, and Nicholas Daniloff hadn't even been in touch with the American embassy, and neither had the Soviet Union. And how did they know that this man, a journalist, was going to be arrested, and how did he know from the New York Times to be at the Daniloff apartment? So was this a plan, and it's been suggested in some newspaper articles, like the Gary Powers, to blow up the future summit? As I say, it boomeranged, and they got a mini-summit and a date for the other summit behind. So Gorbachev got everything he wanted, and Ronald Reagan will look wimpy to the far right and may even get a bullet for his efforts. But Mrs. Daniloff was revealing that for 3 months they knew that he was going to be arrested, and yet, for some idiotic reason, he meets somebody and says on the telephone, and she says all their lines are bugged, "We'll meet you where we met before," which was a year ago, and pictures were taken at that bridge before of other spies exchanging information. Now, September the 2nd, 1986, there was an article in the Washington Post, and Reagan was still vacationing in Santa Barbara. The headline says, "Aides said Soviets plan to put Daniloff on trial." And this article doesn't rule out the possibility of an exchange of Daniloff for the alleged Russian spy, Mr. Gennadily Zakharov. But a few days later, they said, "No, we are not going to exchange. He is a spy, and we're going to try him as a spy." The USSR said, "If Daniloff broke the law, and it's a classic example of espionage, we will try him." The last trial was the American Francis Gary Power, and it involved the U-2, which broke up a possible summit meeting at that time between President Eisenhower and Nikita Khrushchev, and many articles have noticed the similarity of the countries allegedly planning a summit, and then this comes along and would interfere with the summit. And the Soviet foreign minister said the decision for the trial will be in a few days. The matter of importance is that his actions went beyond his usual journalistic activity. And I'm sure they had a lot on him. The editor-in-chief of U.S. News and World Report said this is phony, this is an affront to journalism, this is crude connivance. And his wife, Ruth Danilov, says it's a farce, it's a surrealistic nightmare. They planted evidence on someone, and it is a crude job. Just keep in mind his background and their adjectives and put them next to each other. We'll take a one-minute break, and I'll come back to this as part two of the Danilov series, and I hope I can cover a lot more material in this remaining half hour. Get it done this evening, but I won't be able to. It's just going too fast.